the web at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Capturing the Century, 40 Years of Collecting, a celebration honoring Dr. Howard Gottlieb on the occasion of his 40th anniversary as founder and director of Special Collections at Boston University.
That good man somehow found a dealer who had a Scott letter, and he bought it. I still have that letter. That was 65 years ago, and I have been collecting ever since. Collecting, collecting, collecting.
Actress Angela Lansbury, author and journalist David Halberstam, and other luminaries gather to honor the career of Howard Gottlieb tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The United States is joining Israel in accusing Syria of harboring terrorists after Syria demanded the UN Security Council condemn Israel for an airstrike against a purported militant training camp in Syrian territory today. U.S. Ambassador to the UN John Negroponte.
We believe it is in Syria's interest and in the broader interest of Middle East peace for Syria to stop harboring and supporting the groups that perpetrate terrorist acts such as the one that occurred in Haifa yesterday.
That suicide bombing left 19 people dead. The militant Islamic Jihad group has claimed responsibility. But Syria's ambassador to the UN, Faisal Mekdad, says Israel must not be allowed to stage attacks into neighboring countries with impunity.
We believe that Israel should desist from committing further attacks, and the international community should shoulder its responsibility in preventing Israel.
Also today, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat declared a state of emergency in Palestinian territories and installed a special 8-member cabinet in an apparent effort to deflect possible Israeli action against him. Candidates in California's gubernatorial recall race are wrapping up the weekend with a final flurry of campaigning. GOP candidate Arnold Schwarzenegger has tried to dismiss the sexual harassment allegations against him, including accusations from several more women today, as NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Los Angeles Times reports that four women have come forward with new stories of unwanted encounters with Schwarzenegger. Thus far, a total of 15 women say they were grabbed or groped by the actor, dating back to the mid-70s and some as recently as 3 years ago. In an interview with ABC's Peter Jennings, Schwarzenegger again acknowledged that, quote, some of the things could have happened, end quote. But he says it's odd that no one has come forward to complain before. Governor Davis called the accusations disturbing.
Are all 15 women and their families lying, or is Mr. Schwarzenegger not telling us the truth?
Meanwhile, Schwarzenegger says the accusations are part of campaign trickery by Governor Davis. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
Striking garbage collectors in Chicago have voted not to accept a contract offer that would have ended their walkout. From Chicago Public Radio, Jason DeRose reports.
Teamsters overwhelmingly rejected what area refuse haulers had called their final proposal to end the garbage strike. The Chicago Area Refuse Haulers Association had offered a 15% pay increase over the length of the contract, putting annual compensation at nearly $69,000. But negotiators for the Teamsters recommended members vote against the 5-year contract, saying pay still wasn't high enough. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
And this is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Archbishop Sean Patrick O'Malley asked parishioners to pray for, quote, victims of abortion today. O'Malley celebrated Mass this morning at the Holy Cross Cathedral and attended an annual anti-abortion rally on the Boston Common. The head of the Boston Archdiocese said that the victims of abortion include mothers, babies, and doctors who perform the operations. A company that acts as a liaison between consumers and cheaper prescription drugs from Canada is getting a boost from a Massachusetts mayor. Michael Albano, mayor of Springfield, plans to testify on behalf of RX Depot. The Tulsa-based company is the target of a federal lawsuit that asks to shut it down. Springfield became the first in the nation to have a Canadian drug supplier for its employee health plan. And Red Sox fans are celebrating tonight after the team came from behind in the eighth inning today to beat the Oakland A's 5-4 at Fenway Park. The win keeps the Sox hope for another shot at a World Series alive. They tied the series up with Oakland, now 2-2. Game 5 tomorrow in Oakland. In the forecast, mostly clear tonight, lows between 40 and 45. For tomorrow, partly sunny with highs in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low near 45. Partly sunny on Tuesday with highs in the 60s. Right now, it's 53 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By Lutheran Social Services and their program Good News Garage, accepting drivable cars for donation to families in need. 877-GIVE-AUTO or goodnewsgarage.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org. Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. This past Tuesday night, luminaries from the fields of academia, journalism, literature, film, theater, and music all gathered at Boston University to honor Dr. Howard Gottlieb on the occasion of his 40th anniversary as founder and director of Special Collections, an archive that would, as Gottlieb describes, tell the story of our times through the personal papers of influential public figures, writers, and performers. This evening, we'll hear excerpts from some of the speeches given at last Tuesday night's festivities, including those given by actress Angela Lansbury and Dr. Gottlieb himself. First, we hear from Boston University President-elect Daniel Golden and journalist and author David Halberstam. President-elect Golden is introduced by Chancellor John Silver.
I'm pleased to join all of you in honoring Howard Gottlieb for 40 years of remarkable work and investing David Halberstam as a fellow of the Friends of Library. In 1964, Howard had already recognized Mr. Halberstam's talents, and he then foresaw the illustrious career of one of the best and the brightest. Mr. Halberstam's latest book, The Teammates, offers additional proof of the soundness of Howard's judgment. Halberstam is, in fact, one of the very few native New Yorkers who is capable of appreciating the tragic greatness that is the Boston Red Sox. Last week, another native New Yorker took to the mound in Fenway Park to throw out the first pitch. We at Boston University like to think that the enthusiasm of our ninth president, soon to be inaugurated, inspired the ninth inning rally that followed. We would also, of course, be pleased if we could commemorate our new president's inaugural with a World Series championship. Should these dreams get the better of us, however, we need only refer to Mr. Halberstam's knowledge of the historical record. It is now my privilege to introduce Boston University's president-elect, Mr. Daniel Golden. From April 1992 to November 2001, Mr. Golden served as administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. He enjoyed the confidence of three presidents and the longest tenure of any director of NASA. A review of his accomplishments show why he was entrusted to manage so much for so long. Despite cutbacks in NASA's funding, Mr. Golden launched projects that captured the public's imagination and the Congress's, such as the restoration and spectacular success of the Hubble telescope and the deployment of exploratory robots on the surface of Mars. With relentless energy, Dan Golden restored both the sense of possibility and the pride of accomplishment that had inspired NASA of the Mercury and Apollo missions. Mr. Golden also brings to the university the benefit of his vast experience in research and industry. After graduating from City College of New York in 1962, Mr. Golden worked first as a NASA engineer, studying how electrical propulsion might be used in human interplanetary travel. He then began a 25-year career at TRW, rising to become the general manager of the company's renowned space and technology group. After his tenure as NASA's administrator, Mr. Golden was named senior fellow of the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego. The former leader of a jazz band, Mr. Golden has maintained a deep interest in music and is a voracious reader of literature and history. Boston University has been fortunate to have theologians and philosophers serve as its president, but none before has lifted his eyes to the heavens with a sense of practical wonder that Dan Golden brings to all that he does. Most of us look into space and see unfathomable depths. Dan Golden can look into the sky and trace the orbits of satellites that he has launched. The university's president-elect has a gift for seeing how mankind can bring seemingly impossible goals within our grasp. Who knows? With Daniel Golden coming to Boston, maybe this really is the Red Sox year.
Thank you, Chancellor Silber. I'm new here. I have a lot to learn. Like I said to the new students a few weeks ago, in a way, I'm also a freshman. But for all freshmen, myself included, orientation ends. And I assume at some point, John, you're going to tire of me and stop taking my calls. So I want to take this opportunity to thank you, John, not only for the introduction, but for having the foresight to store so much of your invaluable institutional knowledge right here in the special collections. In other words, thank you for lending me your notes. Let me also thank the Friends of the Library for their undeterred support of this unique treasure. And I'd like to thank David Halberstam for his presence here today and congratulate him as well. And let me thank the very reason we are all here, the person whose persuasion and passion created and has sustained our one-of-a-kind collection, the incomparable Dr. Howard Gottlieb. I am so pleased and incredibly honored to be part of this. By that I mean part of the Boston University community. But in a more specific sense, I also mean to be part of this wonderful and meaningful event. That's because I have always loved libraries. As a kid, I remember my mother holding my hand as we crossed Soundview Avenue in the South Bronx to get to our local branch of the public library. I remember my father teaching me how to use the Dewey Decimal System. The kids today don't need it. I remember when I was finally old enough to go to the library alone. And I remember going for the first time to the main New York Public Library on 42nd Street. I have a feeling that many kids who grew up here in Boston, the city that surprisingly boasts the first publicly supported municipal library in America and the first public library to actually lend a book, felt much the same. Like me, they probably couldn't believe that there were such enormous, beautiful buildings just for books. They were more than buildings, actually. They were temples, shrines. They were the greatest of observatories because long before I wanted to become an engineer, long before I had the privilege to run NASA, long before I knew about things like the Hubble telescope, I did my own exploring at the public library. Here in a library, we are all explorers. Here is where we could connect with the past. Here is where we can really learn and develop critical thinking skills. Here is where we open both minds and new worlds. But the fact is, going back deep into the stacks, pulling out a book and feeling as though you're the very first one, or the first in many years, to flip through its pages, finding the elusive papers or manuscripts that answer a particular question or confirm the theory. These are also tremendous joys in and of themselves. And when you're talking about the opportunity to do so with the volumes and volumes of the primary source, unpublished material collected by Howard Gottlieb over the past 40 years, there is even more truth to that. In other words, it is the excitement of the search. It is not only acquiring knowledge, but being enamored with the process of acquiring that knowledge. It is the very nature of making or sharing in a discovery that makes the collections we have here invaluable, not just for a student pursuing a degree, but for the human condition. I can't think of a better resource or example for our students. It's what education is all about. I truly and deeply believe that. I may not have realized that when my mother was holding my hand as we crossed Soundview Avenue, but that seed of intellectual curiosity that planted and cultivated when I was a child, and it has only grown in my adulthood. In fact, it may explain why whenever I go to a different library or museum, and I've been fortunate enough to go to many of these shrines of learning and temples of history around the world, I make a point of asking my hosts, what can I see here that I can't see anywhere else in the world? In Kansas City, for instance, they let me run my fingers across the first edition of a book by Nicolai Copernicus in its original deerskin cover, dated 1543, not even 100 years removed from the Gutenberg Bible. I couldn't believe they let me touch it. I was also able to turn the pages of two first editions of books by Galileo, in which he confirmed Copernicus's findings. It was blasphemy at the time. I asked a question at the University of Padua in Italy. They answered by allowing me to deliver my speech in the very same room that Galileo spoke from centuries before. What a humbling thrill. In Israel, I asked then Prime Minister Netanyahu about Jerusalem's antiquities. He sent me to another temple, the Rockefeller Archaeological Museum in the Old City. When I got there, a curator brought me downstairs to a room in the basement. He opened a drawer and pulled out a small piece of parchment in a plastic cover. I looked at it. I immediately recognized the Hebrew characters from religious school and asked, "Is this what I think it is?" It was a 2,000-year-old piece of parchment inscribed with one of the Ten Commandments. It sat in a cave for 2,000 years in a vacuum. And here it was, the same things I had learned just 50 years before. In the next room, they were actually using NASA technology, an infrared optical reader, to look at degraded writing on ancient parchment, and to do so at a wavelength the human eye could never see. Talk about connecting the past with the present. Needless to say, here at Boston University, Dr. Gottlieb answered my question too. In this very temple, he showed me the Federalist Papers with James Madison's annotations and many letters written by the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He told me about the archival holdings of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franz Liszt. He mentioned Joseph Conrad and Walt Whitman. But then he started to talk about the manuscripts that were his real pride and joy. Dr. Gottlieb talked of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s papers and the Speaker of the House, John McCormick's, but also Douglas Fairbanks and Bette Davis. He proudly talked about Fred Astaire's dance shoes and Robert Frost's unpublished poems. Then, just as proudly, he described Alistair Cook's handwritten notes on Robert Kennedy's assassination and the letters sent home by a young journalist in Vietnam named David Halberstam. As Dr. Gottlieb continued, and he could have gone all day, two things occurred to me. The first is obvious. What makes this collection so special is that it is a temple unlike any other unto the 20th century. It is not just about history, as we commonly think of it, but it is about recent history and the cultural literacy that are so critical in defining who we are and what we are. The second thing that hit me, and the one point I hope you all remember, is this. When someone comes to Boston University and has the nerve to ask, "What do you have that no one else has?" you could certainly bring them here and show them Gottlieb's collection. I promise you, they will never be disappointed. But if they really want to see something unique, a real treasure in every sense, just introduce them to Dr. Howard Gottlieb. When he first arrived at Boston University in 1963, very few people saw the value in collecting contemporary manuscripts. People criticized it as frivolous pursuit. But Howard Gottlieb understood not only Francis Bacon's words that histories make men wise, but that primary sources of contemporary history were an integral part of this. So he persevered, he persuaded, in his own words, often begged. And because he did, he accomplished more than just providing the university with this archive of the 20th century that is simply unmatched. He almost single-handedly brought value to contemporary manuscripts. That may make those manuscripts harder to obtain than when Dr. Gottlieb got them for free when he first started this enterprise. But it will also inevitably make our shared history that much richer. That's what he's done. He's done that while here at Boston University, and no one else has a Howard Gottlieb. For that, and to honor his pioneering work in the field of contemporary manuscripts, and for his contribution and service to the university, the Board of Trustees, by unanimous vote, has changed the name of the special collections to the Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center, and I will now unveil it. In conjunction with that, it is also my pleasure to announce the center's first fellow. The Wall Street Journal once described his bestseller, War in a Time of Peace, as riveting and indispensable. I think those words are an appropriate description of the author himself. But I'd like to mention one personal point. I remember reading David's book, Summer of 49, about the historical pennant race between the Red Sox and the Yankees. It brought me right back to my childhood. I was there at Yankee Stadium, sitting in the bleachers, as was pointed out by David, much further than today, with my PM5 glove waiting to catch a home run. Like all of his books, it was so vivid, so compelling. Just last week, I saw the Red Sox play at Fenway. I was able to throw out the first pitch. Incidentally, as much as I love posterity, I hope the tape of my two bouncer doesn't make it to your collection. I belong in the Hall of Shame. But the game was great. The Sox came back and won it with a home run in extra innings. I was hoarse for days, and now it's official. I am a Red Sox fan, and I believe in tooth fairies. So I'd like to ask David for a favor. I hope you write another book, David. Autumn of 03, when the Red Sox win the World Series this year. David, what I'm about to announce isn't conditional on that, but chronicling such a worthy feat would be most appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to announce that Boston University has appointed David Halberstam as the first fellow of the Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center.
Thank you very much. Howard called me first 39 years ago. It did not seem likely at that moment that I would be a collectible, or, to use a new phrase, museum embedded. I was just back from Vietnam. I was all of 29 years old, going on 30. I seemed about as likely to be a player here in this great building as Seabiscuit was to win all those races. I had written one book. It had sold some 1,500 copies. And I thought at first when he asked for all my papers that he was kidding, but he was insistent. He is the most insistent man in the world. And the chance, if you live in a New York apartment, to get your papers out of your house, that's the magic. And then, of course, there was the tax break. He mentioned the tax break. And do you remember that moment in Dr. Strangelove when Slim Pickens is out to get the Ruskies, and he says, "And boys, there's going to be medals." Well, Howard sort of said, you know, "Boys, there's going to be tax breaks." Well, not really. At just about that same time, Lyndon Johnson, who knew better than most people how much the government needed taxes, had some papers of his own, and being, I think you could say that Lyndon was a little greedy, went for, I think it was a $500,000 tax deduction on his paper. All the rest of us lost our tax break. So there's been no tax break. Well, it's now 40 years, 18 books later, and it's been great for me. Medals or tax breaks aside, you have my undying gratitude, the undying gratitude of my wife getting those papers out of our house. She is more indebted to you, Howard, than you just realize. And I have no idea really what all of what's in there. I mean, possibly letters from my mother when I was young in Saigon telling me to eat well, from various members of my family reminding me that they had voted for John Kennedy and to stop making him mad. But, I mean, there's just no telling what's in there. And you, Howard, I've just loved it all. You're a great boulevardier. I hope someday Boston has a boulevard worthy of you. You've been more than a librarian. You've been the most joyous and exuberant of citizens in making this building a living place. I'm sure that Tom Menino is thrilled that you never chose to run against him, and likewise Mitt Romney. And I'm sure that John Silber's greatest fear was of coming to work one morning and finding Howard in his seat, surrounded by a palace guard of retired writers, journalists, sculptors, movie stars, and whatever, and being put in charge of the library. You've given us something wondrous, a living museum. Coming here, looking at these exhibits, it's like eating salted peanuts, and your sense of the complexity of people's lives and the odd things that reflect it, letters, old checkbooks. It's a living thing. I just have really one last request. When this administration comes near its terminal date, don't just go for the papers of Rummy and Cheney, but this time go for Gephardt and Tom DeLay so that maybe we could get that tax break back. I'm delighted to be here speaking for you tonight. It has been a pure joy to deal with you.
Journalist and author David Halberstam speaking last Tuesday night at a celebration honoring Dr. Howard Gottlieb on the occasion of his 40th anniversary as founder and director of Special Collections at Boston University. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Still to come, we'll hear from last Tuesday night's honoree, Dr. Howard Gottlieb. But first, the comments of award-winning actress Angela Lansbury.
What a lovely greeting. Thank you. First of all, I must acknowledge the presence here tonight of Dr. Gottlieb, darling Howard, President-elect Dan Golden, Chancellor John Silber, Catherine, trustees of Boston University, and friends of the library, and honored guests. Tonight, we are all enjoying the celebration of the 40th anniversary of the 20th Century Archive, and most importantly, to salute an extraordinary achievement on the part of Dr. Howard Gottlieb. 40 years ago, Howard bravely began the daunting and challenging task of accumulating the letters, publications, trophies, and general memorabilia of what is now a collection of some 1,800 individuals. He has succeeded in establishing what must be the finest collection of published and private papers of the 20th century in this country. Howard, how very proud we are indeed that your beloved special collection will be known forthwith as the Howard B. Gottlieb Archival Research Center. Indeed. We've said it before, and we can say it many times. How did he do it? Well, I can tell you that in my own experience, he did it with infinite patience, ingenuity, kindness, but most importantly, friendship. Howard is the most wonderful friend. He keeps in touch. He remembers our birthdays and Christmas. He knows the names of our grandchildren. He is persona grata big in our lives. Howard really gets around. His travels to conduct the business of the collections takes him all over the world, often accompanied by his wonderful associate director of 27 years, Vita Palladino. The gatherings that he assembles, those intimate little dinner parties to which we are often invited, could be in New York City, Washington, D.C., Paris, Bombay, Palm Beach, you name it. A glamorous life? Yes, you could say so for someone who enjoys the company of the doers and the shakers of the world. And as you do know, Howard is a gourmand of the first order. But there is a very strict purpose behind it all. It is a chance to begin a dialogue that will in turn create a trust, a basis on which an individual will feel comfortable enough to relinquish, you might say, the accumulation and evidence of a life's work, knowing that it will be respected, cared for, preserved, filed, and finally exhibited, as we've seen in the halls, made available to those who come after and who will benefit from having had access to research material that otherwise might end up in an attic, or worse still, a trash bin. I mean, what are papers, apart from rare manuscripts and published works? Just about anything we keep for our own reasons or stash away for reference. Diaries, letters, notes, in some cases scraps as incidental as shopping and laundry lists. Yes, they're all in there. As one person referred to it, and it might have been Howard, I'm not quite sure, it's the effluvia of the great. And what do all these scraps tell us? The researcher, surprisingly more than you'd imagine. So often they reveal the human side of the subjects who might otherwise be judged solely on the brilliance of their accomplishments. I mean, speaking for myself as an actress and entertainer, it's thrilling for me to know that the very small sums of my whole will reside in this collection. And what great company I'm in. My gosh, I mean, Fred Astaire, Betty Davis, George Bernard Shaw, and my good friends here with me this evening, Miss Tammy Grimes, Tammy right there. She and I, we're all in there. As you can guess, actors are a varied lot when it comes to keeping papers and our trophies. Yes, we keep those. Yes, but it's tough to put a bunch of bad reviews into a folder and send them off for posterity. You know, and it's all got to go in there. It's all in the hopper. On the other hand, I like to think that the notes that we keep on the subject of scripts and the characters we play might someday become very useful and enlightening to a young drama student doing research for a role in a production. I mean, I never imagined I would find myself in such an illustrious collection. 5 huge categories, and 1 devoted to suspense and mystery writers. I mean, a whole collection devoted to mystery. I really like that a lot. It's my business, you know. All this accomplished by this brilliantly rare and lovable man who must take sole credit for having, over the years, succeeded first by the unique powers of his intellect and persuasion, and ultimately by bringing the full weight of this great school of learning to bear to create the special collections, now known as the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Warmest congratulations, Howard, and much, much love.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Chancellor of Boston University, Dr. John Silber.
Thank you, Ms. Bloom. It's a great pleasure for me to celebrate the 40 years of achievement by Howard Gotlieb. When I came to Boston University, I recalled, and I mentioned this to Howard, that as I was a graduate student at Yale, I spent many hours in the Sterling Library just looking through the manuscripts that were displayed on the case in that long aisle that was the center feature of that library on the ground floor. And I told him, I said, you know, that's where I read James Weldon Johnson's Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, was because they turned the pages about every week, and I would come back every week to see what the next page said. And I finally got through about a third of it, and I decided, why am I so cheap? So I went out and bought the book, and I got to read it all at once. But it was very nice to see that manuscript and all the changes that the author had made in that manuscript. And then there was Tinker, the wonderful professor, the celebrated professor of English at Yale, who had this enduring correspondence with Sinclair Lewis. And Sinclair Lewis had this correspondence with other authors. Sinclair Lewis had very little experience because these were early letters as an undergraduate. And he would get paid $5 to write out a plot for a more seasoned novelist who had all the experience but not the plot, and they would put them together. Tinker sponsored the relationship between the two. All of that I discovered in that library that I would never have learned any other way. And I said to Howard when I came here, why don't we have anything like that at Boston University? Then he took me upstairs to the special collections, and I said, well, you know, why is it up there? I said, why don't we have something down here? And as you see tonight, as you saw in the reception, we now have the cases on the downstairs so that all that these wonderful things that Howard has collected can be examined by people right there on the ground floor. So our students can see what it's like to know it firsthand, the struggling efforts of young authors and older authors as they try to put their ideas into succinct form. It's useful to remember what Boston University was like when Howard Gotlieb came, and that was 8 years before my arrival. I wish I'd got here when Howard did, because I think there would have been lots of possibilities that we missed. But in any event, he was here for 8 years before I got here. And when he came, we had 780 rare books. We had 168 manuscripts. Now, 40 years later, in 2003, instead of 1963, we have 2,000 archival collections, and we have 140,000 rare books and 54 million manuscripts. And that's the difference that Howard has made. If Boston University ever got desperate, we could probably sell that collection and retire all our debts. But as a matter of fact, we're not going to do that. So we have only one way of measuring the value of his collection, and that is on what the insurance companies will let us insure it for. And right now, they can insure his collection for over $62 million. And this is something that the university hasn't paid for. This is something that Howard has begged for. That reminds me of something that Mr. Berkey said about not letting people get behind the scenes and know about the illusions. You are complimenting Howard on having done just that, on letting us in on the secret. I, on the contrary, have raised hell with Howard occasionally because I said, Howard, don't tell them how you do it. I say, the Wizard of Oz never opens the curtain. And when he does, he makes a hell of a mistake. And so don't do it. Now, these are the two different aspects. One is a searcher for truth, and the other is a searcher for results. I leave it to you who has the better cause. In any event, here we have this great collection that Howard has put together. Just the last year, he acquired over 1,200 linear feet. That's four football fields lined up of manuscripts and books, including Robert Brustein's ART collection and the Stokowski collection and the Somerset Maugham collection. And we've had so many additions to the collections, including Douglas Fairbanks, a widow who gave us so many more pieces, and David Halberstam continues to add to his collection, as does Dan Rather and Petrus Lilly. We've added over 3,000 rare books and three distinguished libraries. We purchased, and this is the only major contribution ever made to special collections or to the Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center by Boston University. We purchased three distinguished libraries of the books written along the Silk Road. And that was the library of Richard Fry, Carl Mengus, and Carl Jetmar. Those collections, which we purchased for $1.7 million, document cultures in Turkestan, Persia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, India, China, and they're also very fine major Islamic collections. Together, this is a library of the Silk Road that supports 17 members of the Boston University faculty who know the languages that enables them to read the documents that are contained in these extraordinary libraries. Boston University, by the acquisition of those libraries, has the finest collection of documents pertaining to the Silk Road of any university or library in the world. It is the foundation for our establishment of an Institute of the Silk Road Studies, which we are in the process of trying to do. But there are problems, and these are problems that I don't hesitate to call your attention to. Howard has run out of space. And it's not surprising. You know, when you bring this much in and there's no expansion of the facilities, something has got to give. There is no further room for expansion in the Mugar Library. Our next project is a campaign to raise $30 million to build a special library, and we'll probably name it for Howard. I wouldn't be surprised if we did. And it'll be a library of about 60,000 square feet to house that collection. Right now, the collection requires about 40,000 square feet, and that gives him some room for expansion. And I hope that I'm going to be able to call on all of you for our major contributions to this effort. Now, one thing, I don't want to leave the impression that the Special Collections is only something wonderful that's all in archives here. This is also a library that's always in use. 164 book projects are underway right now using the materials in the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. There are 49 dissertations being written. 36 documentary films are making use of material that Howard has provided. His website has over 306,000 strikes this past year, and he has well over 1,200 emails and post inquiries about some documents. The documents that are in continual demand and continual examination include those of Martin Luther King, Asimov, Davis, Einstein, and others. We do have some Einstein documents. He is a peripheral scientist at the very least. But the works we have, I don't think, pertain primarily to science. And so it just gives you another aspect of access to what Einstein was about. But no real challenge to the deepest things he was doing in science. One thing that we are very proud about with regard to Howard is his refusal to succumb to the pressures that Mrs. King put on him to divest of all of our holdings in the Martin Luther King collection, because she argued that it was important to bring them all together in Atlanta so that they would be of access to the public. As we now know, she was not interested in that, but rather in putting the entire collection up for sale. But Howard took the line that these papers, in fact, all of the papers of Martin Luther King, should have come to Boston University. But it was Mrs. King who prevented that full acquisition, and Howard insisted that we would hold all that we had, and he had to testify to that effect in a trial that she brought here in Boston, in which the court held that Boston University had clear title to that collection and under no obligation to divest of it. And then later we know that the Martin Luther King collection that belonged to us but is now in Atlanta is up for sale first to the United States Congress, which turned down $30 million for it, and now is up for sale in New York at one of the auction houses. Howard's integrity in defending the gifts to Boston University and the gifts to his collection is one of the qualities that I admire most about him. He pays close attention to the intentions of the donor, and he doesn't violate those intentions no matter what the pressures are. On the other hand, and this is the other side of the coin, Heinrich Böll, when he was a very young man, was spotted by Howard, and Howard acquired his papers. Later on, he won the Nobel Prize. And in his later years, Heinrich Böll became destitute, and he wrote Howard asking for the return of his papers. And Howard, with no obligation to do so, returned the papers to Heinrich Böll because he recognized that it was necessary in order to meet that man's personal needs. These are the two aspects and two contrasts of Howard that appeal to me very greatly. His humanitarian concern for the welfare of one of his donors, and on the other hand, his redoubt refusal to succumb to any kind of pressure. That makes a great collector, and it is another one of the reasons why we all revere Howard Gotlieb and all that he's accomplished. Howard, we salute you, and we're waiting to raise the money to build that building of yours so that your collection has adequate space in which to flourish and further to grow.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the moment we have all been waiting for. I'd like to introduce, not necessary, I'm sure, our guest of honor, our most loved, admired, and honored Dr. Howard Gottlieb.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, for me to say that I've been so very touched and moved by the generous and kind things that have been said about me this evening would be a massive understatement. This is an evening I shall never forget. But this celebration is not for me or about me. It's for the collection and about the collection, because that collection, which has been gathered here, will be here for generation after generation of researchers who produce work after work from it, and that is the important thing. I wish to thank that great artist, Claire Bloom, for her masterly and gracious emceeing of this evening, and thank Angela Lansbury, my dear friend of many years, coming all the way from Ireland to say those nice things about me. And I wish to thank those individuals here whose papers are in the collection, my collectees as I call them, David Halberstam, Brad Washburn, Tammy Grimes, Nora London, for her husband's papers, George London, and Phyllis Curtin, and Sandra Warfield McCracken, and Frank Evrouche, and Marion Christie, and Robert Brewstein. I thank you all for placing your papers here and for coming this evening. I'm honored that President-elect Golden and Mrs. Golden are here. When I was 12 years old, my father asked me what I wanted to have for my birthday. And I had just read Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, and I was swept away by the splendor and grandeur of that novel. And I read everything that Scott wrote. So I said to my father, I should very much like to have something in Scott's handwriting. Well, my father must have thought he had an odd son indeed to want something like that rather than a tennis racket or a new bicycle. But that good man somehow found a dealer who had a Scott letter, and he bought it, and he gave it to me. The letter didn't say much. It was Scott refusing an invitation. But I cherished it, because for me that was not an inanimate object. It was something alive and palpable, something that the great novelist had held, had handled himself, had written upon, had put his thoughts down upon, and I cherished it. I still have that letter. That was 65 years ago, and I have been collecting ever since, collecting, collecting, collecting. All through school, all through university, all through the army, all through the war, all through the years that I was a young newspaper man, and then to have the opportunity to come to Boston University to build the collection here. And of course, I didn't build it by myself. I had a great deal of help. I'm grateful to all those who placed their papers and their book collections at Boston University. I'm grateful to the trustees, to the friends of the library for their generosity and their patience, to my wonderful staff, particularly my chief associate, Vita Palladino, whose loyalty and devotion and knowledge of the field gained over many years have been of immense help to me, for which I'm most grateful. These are the people who have helped me build that collection, and that is what is so very important about it. I also wish to say that the 20th Century Archives does not end with the 20th century. We're going to continue to collect, and the collection will continue to grow, all the time. I'm very grateful to Provost Berkey for his understanding and good advice over the years, and most particularly to Chancellor John Silber, who for nearly four decades has encouraged me, prodded me when I was discouraged about having lost a collection to the gushing oil wells of Texas. He'd say, forget it, move on to the next project. When I would suggest that a collection was perhaps unobtainable for us, he would say, nonsense. You have the acquisitiveness and the morals of a highwayman. Go after it. And I would. He and Catherine have given me the most fruitful years of my career, and I do thank them for that. Everyone wishes to leave some sort of legacy. Betty Davis once said to me, I shall never die, Howard. Someone, somewhere will always be watching me on that screen. Well, perhaps Betty was prophetic in talking about her own legacy. But in a less dramatic fashion, I like to think of all the books yet to be written, all the dissertations yet to be researched, all the honors papers yet to be submitted, based on the 60 million documents which we've gathered here, and perhaps, just perhaps, some small part of me will be in that work. And for that, I am extraordinarily grateful, as I am extraordinarily grateful to all of you for being here tonight. Thank you.
Dr. Howard Gottlieb, speaking last Tuesday night at a celebration in honor of his 40th anniversary as founder and director of Special Collections at Boston University. Earlier, we heard from actress Angela Lansbury, journalist and author David Halberstam, Boston University President-elect Daniel Golden, and Chancellor John Silber. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and George Hicks, with help from John Perotti. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us. Massive stone figures seem to guard Easter Island. Their stern, impassive faces stare inward across the island as they have for hundreds of years. The builders of these sculptures have long since vanished, but their culture can still whisper to us in the island's traditional crafts, dance, and music. Join Sylvia Pujoli and visit Easter Island as part of our next Citizens of the World tour to South America. Call 800-909-9287. This is WBUR. Coming up just ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment.